welcome to this episode of Screen Divers. In this episode, myself, Steve, and Ricky are taking you back. We're dragging you down to 1986. Today, we are covering Pretty in Pink, written by John Hughes and directed by Howard Deutsch. Ricky picked this movie.
Hello, I am Ricky.
Hey, I'm Steve. I just want to ask one quick question, Ricky.
Sure.
Why did you choose this movie? What was your thought process on choosing this movie?
Well, it's a bit of a selfish reason, but I'm currently going through a John Hughes fest. I started off with 16 Candles about 3 weeks ago. And I was very much like, I think I watched 16 Candles and I was a little bit like, I don't know whether it's because it's been a long time since I'd seen it, but it felt very, there was a lot of slapstick and a lot of weird humor in it that I don't remember. So I was like, I wonder if I start going down this John Hughes line, especially with the films.
Your perception of it has changed a little?
Yeah, and especially the films that I didn't watch multiple times, like Breakfast Club or
Ferris Bueller.
Whether they were as strange and oddball as sort of this. So I thought, you know what, this would be great to do for my first choice for this podcast, which would be Pretty in Pink.
That's a good choice. And I watched it with Steve. Steve and Mari came over for dinner. It was myself, Anna, Steve and Mari. And it was quirky. And not only that, I realized something that I never realized before. First of all, is don't groan. Don't get crazy, okay? Because Steve already doubled down on giving me shits about it. I think this is the first time I watched this movie in its entirety. And I caught glimpses of it in the past. Either someone was watching it or attempted to watch it and I wasn't ready for it. And I wasn't in the right frame of mind for it. Let's just put it that way. One of the things that I did notice on this viewing, which gave me immense pleasure actually, is something that it's probably obvious, but something that I never noticed. Back in 1994, my life changed. And it changed when I watched two movies that I hired together from the video store. Those movies were Clerks by Kevin Smith, and the other one was Lahain. Now, and in that session, my entire idea of cinema and film changed completely. And I was like, oh my God, I would love to do this, actually. This is great. And not only that, but dialogue. The importance of dialogue. This, not only in retrospect, when I think about it, guys, we grew up in the golden age of Miramax before all the shit came out with Harvey Weinstein, whatever. But this is when independent cinema really was approachable by a young person, a tween or a teenager. And I gotta say, on this viewing, I really realized how much Kevin Smith pays tribute to Hughes' writing.
I 100%.
And I feel stupid for not realizing that before. Like even down to the interactions in tracks in the record store, which we're going to talk about later, some of the transitions in this movie as well, which by the way, let's not take anything away from Howard Deutsch, the guy that directed this. He collaborated several times with Hughes before. He's a very serviceable director. You know, he's not, I mean, he had the pleasure of working with people with, which we're going to discuss later. And one of them is the cinematographer here is the DOP, the director of photography, is Tak Fujimoto. Let's not forget what this guy is. He did Ferris Bueller. He did Silence of the Lambs. I'm going to talk about parallels between these movies as well, because it shoots in a very particular way.
Oh, I can't wait to hear your connection between Silence of the Lambs and Pretty in Pink. This would be great.
No. Well, the connection is between Silence of the Lambs and Ferris Bueller.
But fair.
Then you catch a glimpse here. It's about fourth wall and what you can do when you are behind the lens, if you have certain intentions. And Mr. Fujimoto does things in a particular way to draw you in. It's a shame he's not working anymore. I actually looked him up today. I think he stopped working in 2013, but I could be wrong. See my notes, which you can probably hear through the mic, listeners, now. I think he stopped working in... Anyone here that has any clue?
2013.
So I was right, 2013.
You were right.
He's old. He's very, like, he's an older gentleman. So he probably made the conscious decision to stop working for whatever reason, but it's a shame.
And also, he is royalty in Hollywood.
Yeah.
Mentioned films like Badlands, Cannonball.
He's an amazing
Cannibal,
amazing,
definitely.
100%. Amazing artist, master of his craft, really. So that's the thing. Like, I was surprised. I was really surprised. Steve was surprised as well when I admitted to it. I had to admit to it. I was like, and you know what? I think we all had slightly different reactions to the movie because it was four of us watching it. But Ricky, like Steve posed the question, why did you pick this movie? We're going to talk about it later, but at the end, did you enjoy it?
Sorry, guys, I've got a cat with me.
I didn't ask you if you think it's a good movie or it's a timeless movie, or did you enjoy the watch and did Sally enjoy the watch?
I think we have got a few other things to chat about before we get into that sort of deep
dive. No, we're
going
to get to it, but just give me a yes or no.
No, I'm not going to talk about that yet because we haven't even introduced the film. We haven't even talked about the plot of the film. We haven't done our normal format.
Wait a second. Fine. I don't care.
I just have to ask a question.
You picked the movie, so here's the overview. It needs to come from you. What's the movie about?
Okay, well, it's funny that you said that I picked the movie, so I say the overview, because I've been doing the overviews every episode so far.
So far.
It's all right. Okay, give us the overview.
So the plot of this movie is actually almost as standard as you can get for any rom-com teenage romance film, which is girl from the wrong side of the tracks, boy from the rich end of town. They somehow go to the same high school, and it's about the ups and downs of their relationship and how they get together, if they're going to get together, and the trials and tribulations that they hit throughout.
So it's an amalgamation of Romeo and Juliet and Cinderella, basically.
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Because that's what it is. At its core, that's if you put these two stories together and then you throw fucking James Spader in it being an asshole, which we're going to talk about.
I'm dying here.
Anyway, you just described the movie. You described
the movie.
It
was perfect, wasn't it? It was a good description. I've been working on that all day because I knew that I would get posed that question.
Yeah.
But I want to talk to now Steve, and I want to talk to Steve about – so we've talked to me about why I picked the movie. We talked to Umbar, who realized that he had never seen the movie fully. So, Steve, your history with this film.
Right. So, I saw this as a teen. For me, this is only the second time I've watched the movie in its entirety. Again, it's one of those situations where you watch a movie when you're in that area of your life. This is 1986. So I was young, so I must have seen it on on a TV rerun at some point, or something like that. But I remember it being one of those movies which came up around or got played a lot around a certain friend's house. So it was one of those things that when we were sorry about this, guys. I have a cat.
It's a cat? It's a cat touching your microphone?
Yeah, a cat trying to attack
the microphone. On. Yeah.
And get my attention right now. So this is going to be cut.
No, it's not. Keep going. Okay. I'm not cutting any of this out.
Excellent. So none of it. We're going to have cat purrs on the microphone.
Yes.
Excellent. So when that kind of comes around, you have very distinct memories of a movie. You may not capture all those memories in my advanced age, but it was nice to revisit it and see the quirkiness, the upbeatness. It was great to see Annie Potts doing
the
Banshees style, you know, craziness and stuff like that. And she's an amazing actress.
Yeah. We're gonna talk about her.
One of my crushes from this movie, I have to say that.
Yeah, likewise.
Yeah.
Likewise. All right, the cast. Let's talk about the cast of this movie. And not only that, but the year release, we talked about 1986. Do you know what other movie came out in 1986?
No, because I was 2 years old.
So I'll tell you. I'll tell you. It's another anomaly where we have a director releasing, or a writer-director, two big, big movies. The cover Rite of Passage in this case, so it's a similar thematic. And the other movie was Ferris Bueller.
Yeah.
Released in 1986. These are both movies were extremely profitable, made for less money than you think, and both movies made a ton of money.
Ferris Bueller especially. I know Ferris Bueller had some issues with the original cut. And I think, yeah. So the original cut of the Ferris Bueller had to be rearranged. They rearranged all the content to have the fair at the end, whereas it was at the beginning of the original shoot.
Yeah, no doubt, no doubt. Like so, I mean, it's not only that, but it's a very unconventional movie as well.
Of course.
At one point in the future, we'll have to cover it. But the thing is, it's interesting to me that you have a similar team working on two large projects around the same time. Like Tak Fujimoto, for example, the director of photography, back-to-back worked on these two movies. And, you know, you have John Hughes, even if he's not, he wasn't. I assume that that's part of the reason as well why he wasn't directing this. Because he was
supposed to.
Yeah. But at the same time, he was on the set quite a bit for this. Because Ringwald wouldn't have taken the job without it. It was also the last time they were together. But that's a different story.
That's another story completely.
Yeah,
that's
another story altogether. And
so shall we go back to the question you asked me?
Well, you let me finish and I'll tell you. we were talking about the cast.
Yeah, okay.
And when it comes down to the cast, boy, what a cast. Really.
It's fantastic. What an amazing cast this film has.
It is an amazing cast. And the thing is, funnily enough, the supporting cast is way better than the two leads in this.
Yes.
You have Andrew McCarthy. You have Andrew McCarthy and it's not interesting. It's actually really like in your face, really, if you think about it. The love interest in the movie, the two leads are Andrew McCarthy and Molly Ringwald. And I can tell you that every time Dean Stanton was on screen, every time James Spader was on screen, every time Annie Potts was on screen, every time John Cryer was on screen,
they stole the show. Yeah,
they 100%. Absolutely steal the show.
Yeah.
And it's unusual and it's unfortunate, but I wonder if this is also another one of the reasons why Ringwald kind of decided to stop working with John Hughes.
Now, I want to combat that opinion because it is an opinion. And I'm not going to defend Andrew McCarthy because...
He's indefensible in this, really.
And Andy McCarthy, like one of the first shots you see of Andy McCarthy when he comes to chat to Molly Ringwald at the record store, there was a moment where I was like, oh God, his teeth are so bad. Like, what the heck? there was a moment where like there was this really goofy smile he gives and I'm like, that's the leading man? Oh God. but
Blaine, it should be a major household appliance.
So what we got to remember is that he wasn't supposed to be the leading man.
No.
Who was meant to be the leading man, Steve?
So the leading man was actually supposed to be Ducky. So John Cryer.
Yes.
That's not what I heard, sir. What I heard is that the role of the leading man was offered to Spader. And actually Spader decided to go for a bad guy because it's much more entertaining to play a bad guy,
right? But I think Steve is referring to the fact that the storyline, the script itself, was completely changed.
Yeah. Basically, the entire ending was reshot.
And wait a second. Let me address Ricky here for a moment. I just heard what Steve had to say, Ricky. So I understand what he meant as well. And we have the same notes, sir. What are you talking about? Steve,
sorry.
Are we
making? Are we making this podcast for just the three of us or for a wider audience?
We are making this just for the three of us. If someone wants to listen to it, they can, sir.
I don't understand why they would.
That's exactly it. And if you start recording for other people, it's not going to work. So I can tell you, if you're listening, thank you for listening. If you're not listening, who gives a shit? Right, so Spader was meant to take the lead. You're right, Also, there's a lot of like musical chairs played with the cast, right?
Yeah, so there were a lot of different people which auditioned and turned down parts. I believe John Cryer was another choice. I think.
Do you remember who was meant to take John Cryer's role?
So.
I'll tell you.
I can't remember.
Charlie Sheen,
yeah.
Funnily enough, two guys then ended up working together 20 years later.
Yeah, so there is an interesting story about that because So when they actually went through this with the cast, Molly Ringwald didn't want Charlie Sheen.
No.
Because he looked too square-jawed, too, you know, yeah.
I mean, it's ultimately, this is the role that I guess defined an entire generation, two generations later, if you think about it. Yeah. And by that, what I mean is, if you look at the dancing sequence with John Cryer, that's the birth of TikTok, pretty much.
Pretty much, yep.
And the friend zone. It's going to be the biggest depiction of being friend zoned by somebody. Absolutely riveting stuff. Not only that, but I saw a different take on Cryer's character, on Ducky. Did you know that he is... well, I think years later, Molly Ringwald basically, in an interview, said that she thought that Cryer's character, Ducky, is basically someone who is gay but didn't know it yet, who basically comes out of the closet later in life. Mm. And if you think about it, it kind of,
There's a lot of stylization that goes on with the Ducky character.
Absolutely. He's a gay icon. Did you know that?
Yeah,
I didn't know
that. And he's it screams a closeted teen, especially from the 80s, where you kind of look at the yuppie stylings of James Spader and Blaine, and then you've got this alternative crowd. And they, you know, their taste in music and all of that stuff never gets properly explained. And the bands that they're listening to at that club range from like punk music to hillbilly rock to all of a sudden this very like folky, downplayed music as well. So you're club is this?
I kind of like what he tried to do with the music here, though, because it gets a reflection of the times as well. If you remember, the top 10 or the charts have various genres in it. Now there's kind of this homogenized feeling that everything that is mass-produced sounds exactly the same. And it's, as much as I sound like an old man saying it, we're talking about the charts. We're talking about, you know, just popular music in general tends to sound the same. I think it's the inevitable kind of peak of this. If it's a curve, I think it was inevitable that in 20 years or 30 years, it was going to end up that way, pretty much, because there's a certain structure to what's popular, musically, sonically speaking. So so I'm not saying that that's a bad thing. It's just inevitable and that's it. But Did you know that obviously Hughes had a complete hold over what music was going to be played in this movie? And one of the things that I heard, because actually I watched this with Steve, and Steve knew every single one of the songs and why they were there. So I thought, I've got to find some info. He had to throw at Steve because he was doing really my head in while we're watching the movie. And I had to keep darting my eyes towards him going, can you keep it for the podcast? Can you shut the fuck up?
And even pointing out that Maury Ringwald's then boyfriend, I can't remember, Zappa's son,
Dweezil.
In one of the scenes. Dweezil Zappa.
And by the way, when he did that, I went on IMDb immediately. And the last person put in the credits blew my mind.
Yeah.
Richard Patrick from Fielder. Mm. He plays one of the students. Oh, did I take one of the fucktoids away from you? By fucktoids, sexual toys from the future. That's not tidbits, but that's what we're going to call them. We're going to call them fucktoids.
Go on. Are they just droids? But like,
until the machine rises, then there's not going to be any more abuse or exploitation. Well, go on.
As I picked this film, I've got to admit, I've been okay. So you asked me the question earlier, like, how did I feel rewatching this film? So this film, I decided I wasn't going to take extensive notes. I was just going to sit down and enjoy this film. Because it's been a while since I'd seen this film, so I'm just going to sit down, enjoy it as if, you know, I'm like rented it from the video store, stuck it in the machine, and just like, oh, I've got to give this back tomorrow. So
way to
go.
That's the way to do it.
That's kind of how we work as well.
Yeah. And I hope you did enjoy it, but you're going to tell us later at the end. So
I will tell you later. But because I like picked it, and afterwards I was imagining, what are we going to chat about with this film and all that? What sort of aspects are we going to look at this film? Yeah. I went on a super deep dive. I have picked up every single fact as part. I've like gone through the cast list. I have tried to figure out like who was dating who and why were they there and why is James Spader such a douche in this film?
What a waste! No, he wanted to play an evil person.
Energy and research. But anyway.
Yeah, and I've done it in 4 days, though. I feel like I've learned every single fact about this film.
All right, okay, I'll go first, then Steve can question you as well. So, we'll like a little trivia show, all right? So you go all the stuff, right?
Steve, I try to get as much...
Steve, ask him a question.
Oh, God.
Yeah, but a bit of trivia that you know, and see. Let's see how deep was this dive. Let's see if you actually screen dived, sir.
Is that like when an artist like takes the name of an album or a song and then slips it through?
Kinda. Who else was also almost played Blaine?
I was gonna say Robert Downey Jr., but that was Ducky.
That's correct, but that's not the question.
Because we already know.
We already know. we already know.
And we brought that up.
Charlie Sheen, because you guys have already brought him up.
Mm-hmm.
And I want to say, was it Rob Lowe?
It just was.
You know what?
At this point, it could have been, I guess. But tell us who it was.
There was such a huge list. Like, I know that. They tried to get like there was like four different names tied to Andy, the role of Andy, including including there was like a load of people from St. Elmo's Fire, including Demi Moore was like one of the names that was mentioned.
Was it Hall from 16 Candles? No, he was also up to play John Cryer's character.
Yes.
And he didn't want to do it because he didn't want to get typecast.
Hilariously, he didn't want to get typecast after being the Breakfast Club.
Yeah. Well, if you think about it, but it's not the, you know, his career really took off after. So it's not, you know. Yeah, he was.
All right. So, all right. Yeah. You've stumped me on the first question. Well done. Well done, Umber. You're well done.
No, that
well
was
done.
Steve. Don't clap for me. That was Steve. Okay, wait a second. Wait a second, Steve. I got a question for him because this is interesting. And I know you know the answer for this. You must. You must. So what is the thing that James Spader did? Let me finish the question. What is the thing that James Spader did? And Steve, you're already mouth open like great dance. You're not playing for this fridge and stove ensemble.
Can I go for, Ricky May I go win? For the board game just to the right of you?
You're going for the board game?
Yeah.
Okay. We went from a, I don't know why we went from the 60s to whatever the fuck era it is that they give in board games. Maybe now, because we kickstarted costing hundreds of thousands. Right, okay, wait a second. So, what is the thing that James Spader did during his audition that was almost responsible for him not getting the role and was also responsible for him getting the role?
So first of all, he was very dismissive to both John Hughes and Howard Deutsch. And then during his thing, he was very like monotone. And then he started smoking a cigarette. And just as he left, he threw the cigarette into the ground and heeled it into the carpet and didn't even say goodbye and just walked out.
I'm so proud of you. Well done, dude. You nailed it. You absolutely nailed it. That's the thing he did. And let's talk about Spader.
Let's talk about Spader.
What a douchebag.
Oh, he's so amazing.
Yeah, I know. But, man, he's the perfect all the way through his career. He's beginning to look like John Lithgow, by the way. I watched an interview with him recently. Mm. He's beginning to look. I noticed two things about it. The first one I noticed is, and bear with me because it's a big revelation here. Listeners, we're not recording for you, but if you're listening, right, we're sharing this pearl of wisdom with you, something, or maybe I'm just an idiot that never realized this. I always thought that there will never be, or there was never somebody, not even close to the type of acting that Christopher Walken has been churning out for years when it comes down to his diction and his pacing whenever he talks, right? And yet, I noticed this time around that if there is another actor that can be placed next, and this doesn't take away from Christopher Walken at all, okay, because it's not a put on; it's just the way they are, you know. But with Spader as well, is the other actor that I can put right next to him when it comes down to his delivery. He does have a particular way he...
Certain cadence.
There's the way he stops and starts again, or the way the pitch of his voice changes, or the energy that goes into the next sentence. It's quite particular. And man is slappable in this.
Oh, he's so good.
But he's got that perfect amalgamation in ways of being charming and revolting at the same time. Like, it's got that creepy kind of... He's extremely charismatic, and yet you're repulsed by him.
Sally, like, said to me, like, that was very strange seeing Spader the way he was, because she remembers Spader the most from Stargate. That was like when she first got exposed to Spader as just a geeky guy who knows a lot about architecture and history and all that stuff.
Right. Yeah.
And then the second one was Boston Legal. Now, she can't remember whether he was sleazy or whatever in Boston Legal.
Oh, he was.
But I said to her, actually, I thought that was the perfect James Spader version of James Spader I know, because of Sex, Lies, and Videotapes, the secretary. Him playing Robert California in The Office, just this really sleazy, really like absolutely cutting individual. And I was like, that was like, if anything, perfected what James Spader did for the rest of his career. Pretty in Pink was like, sort of like, this is what this guy's gonna be for the rest of his life.
Defined him as an actor. Like, you know, if he winged it, then he set the pace for the rest of how people perceive him. Like, so it's for the rest of his career.
I actually wanted to, now I've only done a little bit of this, so please humor me on this. I wanted to take every single line of of James Spader's dialogue from Pretty in Pink, and just read it out. But I've only done it for the first time you see James Spader, because I think it's almost perfect setup for a bad guy I've ever read or ever heard. So his...
Have you got it?
I've got it right here, man.
Please tell me.
So it's like, oh, see you later, guys. Andy, you look ravishing. So we graduate in a month. Now, I want to know, when is it that you and I are going to get together and do something? Well, I'm talking more about than just sex here. You know, I've liked you for 4 years and you treat me like shit, you know? I don't understand what's the problem. Oh, you know, I've been out with a lot of girls at this school. I don't see what makes you so different. And then the killer, the best bit of this scene is, you're a bitch, you know? I think you ought to see a doctor, 'cause that condition of yours could get a lot worse. And then he leaves. And it's so good. It's like, in that moment, you're just like, he's the worst guy in this film.
Mega creep. He's equivalent of the guy going, hey, beautiful, you want to go out? No, thank you. I have a boyfriend. Fuck you then.
Like, yeah,
it's the equivalent of. Man, he's a creep.
It's so. And like, there's another line he says that Sally loved the most, but again, sums up his character so well. And remember, like, he's part of the rich crowd, the crowd that, like, throws parties, destroy their parents' houses, and never gets any repercussions for it. And his line is, money really means nothing to me. Do you think I'd treat my parents' house this way if it did?
Yeah.
Yeah, as he's running a joint, by the way.
Yeah.
He's running a joint because it's out of frame, but you know what he's doing.
Yeah. It's so good. Oh, it's just, his character is just sums up to me what this film is really about, which is like, as you said, Romeo and Juliet and Cinderella.
Yeah.
That's what this film is.
He plays a total Chad. That's what basically he plays. And it's he plays the type of character that, you know, in Your Honor, for example, whatever, like if you were a kid and you came from and you just ran over someone with the car, you would expect your parents to just cover it up. Basically.
Yeah. it's like there are a lot of TV series at the moment or over the past 10 years where we see this character over and over again. Yeah. And
they're real, man.
They are it's privilege. Yeah, but not only that, they are there for the audience to instantly go, oh, I don't like this guy. No.
Of course. No, of course it's a good device. It's a very good device. When it comes down to the supporting cast, you know, we talked about Spader now. I think we could talk about Spader for hours,
forever.
Right? Yeah.
100%.
Yeah. But I got to say, besides, obviously, John Cryer can't really be defined. He's almost not a supporting character. I mean, he's on the cover of the film. Like, he's also the other love interest. And it's, you know, the ending of the movie was rewritten. And the version that hopefully one day we'll see the original ending, because apparently that's not. The ending that we got in this movie was the one that the original ending tested with people when they did a screen test when the movie was released originally. And it didn't work out with the crowd. So they had to change that. But Cryer has the right to be on that cover. So I cannot consider him supporting cast here.
No, he's not.
But who is supporting cast? That's all the show. There's two. We're going to talk about the first one. Steve. Harry Dean Stanton.
Oh, Harry Dean Stanton. Yeah. My God. Man. Yeah, I mean.
He's so fucking good.
I forgot he was in the movie. Yeah, until we sat down.
And I did as well.
Pretty much one of the first things which pops up as from a name.
Yeah.
And I was just like, oh,
yeah. The opening credits, yeah.
Yeah, opening credits. I mean,
You know what I noticed when I watched this? Ricky, I hope you noticed this as well. How much range he has, man. Because the characters that he plays, and it's a job of a character actor to do that, but not to this extent, because usually there's a certain amount of emotional charge, but not that much. And here, he does it so well. It looks and feels like a real person. It really, really, really does. It's on screen. He's on screen for probably 5 minutes throughout the entire movie. But that entire sequence with her as well, it just brought me back to thinking about the roles that I grew up watching him in that blew my mind. Like, you could argue that Paris, Texas is one of the most heartbreakingly beautiful movies and heart-wrenching as well ever made because of that ending. It's also a movie that will teach you how to be rewarded by a movie that paces really slowly and then has a payoff that is gigantic at the end. Really, there's actually no other movie that I could compare to Paris, Texas when it comes down to the payoff at the end.
True.
No other movie.
And I find with this character that he was playing, it's so easy that he could have played it one note. Like,
yeah, you know, no, he doesn't.
Of course, the baseline of his character is he's an alcoholic whose wife has left him. That's the base of the character.
Yeah, and he could have played it one note. It's never bluntly said to you, stated, but there's a particular sequence when it's you'll notice it. Yeah.
But I mean, Steve, how did you feel about the scene with Andy, Molly Ringwald's character, towards it's like in the last act of the film?
So you're meaning the dress sequence where they're having a very touching moment, or
probably actually talk about both.
So one of the key things that you get from that is that he's not turning up to the job. He's not turning up to the job interviews. This guy's going straight to a bar. And yet he's possibly sold a car to buy a dress at the same time.
So yeah, there's a lot of impulsivity in his car. You're right. It's the way it's posed to the viewer, though, it's very subtle.
Yeah. Because
the movie doesn't want to take the focus away from what the story's about. But I get it. You're right. I actually didn't think about the car.
No. So, and the fact that he every single time he looks at her, he sees her mom. That's it.
Yeah.
That's the key emphasis on this. And he's struggling because every single time he looks at her face, he sees his wife. Mm. And he's still in love. He's still in love. She's walked out 3 years before, and he's still in love with her.
Mm.
That's an emotional charge. And you have to follow your heart. Have to follow your dreams. That's it. That's kind of what he's stating.
Absolutely.
And if it hurts, it hurts.
Yeah. Go with it. It's amazing how he managed to do that with very little screen time. It's just amazing. He's an amazing actor. Do you remember how endearing the way, the sequence, the entire sequence is great. The camera's pretty far away as well. And you've got both of them in the frame. It's Ducky and Jack and their father talking.
Yeah.
And there's moments in which, you know, there's an interplay between the two of them. Ducky has decided that he's declaring his undying love for his daughter to the father, which is a very unusual thing to do, you know, when you're so far away from whatever this relationship that was in Ducky's mind was going, okay, where he wanted the relationship to be. You can see the way Jack is looking at him, which is kind of almost, there's a level of amusement without malice. Which is, that's kind of sweet without saying it, but it's just the way he looks at him. I don't know if you remember the sequence in question.
It's just that the way he turns around. And
but that's not the reason. He doesn't look at him like, oh, you're, you know, this is a joke and you're not a threat at all. But it's more like he's thinking about young love, or he's thinking about the way he met his wife, basically.
And the whole theme for the whole movie is that, you know, unrequited love, or the love that's just out of reach, or what you have to work for to get the love that you want, sort of thing. Now, let's talk about Annie Potts.
Ah, yes.
Okay.
Iona, I had a very... Iona.
I have a very... I loved her character, but I have a very, like, looking at it through the eyes of now, the current culture and stuff.
Right.
She gave up all of her quirkiness for a guy, didn't she?
For one guy, yeah.
She gave up all of her quirkiness, right?
Yeah.
Like, she's an amazing character, and she's probably one of the best characters of the film. But by the end of it, she was like, you know what? It's too hard trying to figure out what my own identity is, and I'm too quirky. So you know what? This guy.
So this guy,
you know that she's much older. She's the Andy's boss. You know that, right?
Yeah, yeah. But she's like at least 10 years older than Andy.
Yeah. So and it's also the '80s. People aged at a different rate. So I assume that it got to that point in which she had to settle. But you're right. That all the creativity that she exuded before all of a sudden goes out the window.
Mm-hmm.
I get it.
But it feels like that scene may have been added in as a foretelling.
Perhaps. But also it seems as well that she's role-playing that as well.
Yeah.
Because when she's getting ready to go out, all of a sudden she's dressed like what she envisioned a yuppie to wear.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So there's a lot of... You know what I mean? Like, she's putting
while
on a costume.
She's still singing this thing. In the background and being quirky.
Yeah.
So,
So it's a dreamer through and through, you know. But I
just also, and her reaction to Ducky, like, stealing a kiss from her, and like that whole scene. But the swearing in this film took me by surprise, because I did not remember how much swearing and how much creative swearing there was in this film. I loved it. I thought it was amazing. But
it's
like
unusual for the era. Yeah.
Yeah. Because like the R word gets thrown around quite hard in one of the scenes. And just like the ballsy, like her when she like faces Blaine finally for Blaine basically being like, I don't think I want to go to the prom with you anymore, Andy. All of that stuff. What I found really brilliant about that was that she reacted exactly how a teenage girl would, which is like threw him against the locker and been like, F you.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I also like how Spader creepingly is watching the peep show, you know, by the stairs.
From the stairs. And,
Super creepy. Like mouth half open, like.
It's my chance.
I haven't told you. She's not one of us. She's
I haven't
not
had
one
her
of us.
In 4 years, but nor can you.
No, absolutely phenomenal. Did you guys know that that school that is, it might as well be another fucking, No. You didn't bring it up. What? Okay, let's see. What am I going to say about the school, Steve?
Are you going to say that the school was also used in another movie?
Yeah.
Yeah? Shall I say it?
Throw
or do
it in
you
there,
want
man.
To say
Don't ask permission. Just throw it in there.
It's a film which was used in Greece.
Yes, it was.
Yeah.
Yes.
Greece is the word.
Yeah. It was. Yeah. Yes. What?
Which is a weird situation because Mary compared this movie to Greece on the way home.
Yeah.
And said that Greece was a much better movie.
It's debatable, of course.
Yeah.
But it's a cult status. But again, listen, what you think of Greece. Yeah.
Talking about that, it was a reason why John Hughes, pretty much after making this movie, which, by the way, this is by no means a bomb of a movie. This movie made a lot of money.
It did.
Probably even before it got released. There was so much hype behind this movie, and there were so many billboards and all of that stuff. There was so much going for this movie.
Absolutely.
That it was never going to be a flop. It was always going to be a hit, regardless.
Yeah. This is the third movie in the Brat Pack trilogy, whatever you want to call it.
Yeah.
And also, it cost $9 million to make. And U.S. money alone in the U.S.
And some people would argue,
that was a lot of money.
Some people would argue, because St. Elmo's Fire also came before this, it was made maybe even the fourth movie, because if you include 16 Candles, blah, 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 blah.
Yeah.
But what I found really interesting about that, that this movie was such a hit, John Hughes hated some of the editing and the choices that were made other producers and by the system, the movie system, that he
Paramount.
He made the same movie again the following year. Some Kind of Wonderful is the same exact movie again that got released the following year, but instead of Ducky not being the whatever, the winner of Andy.
The underdog, because that's what he is in this movie.
Yeah, the underdog. Pretty much. He flipped around the genders. So Andy was played by Eric Stoltz, and I can't remember what his character is in Some Kind of Wonderful. And it was just the same movie again, but this time with the original ending.
Yeah, and the gender
flip. What year was Back to the Future released? The first one.
Was it 88 or 85?
No, I think it was around this time. Man, anything between 82 and 88 just murdered when it comes down to timelessness.
Yeah.
Unbelievable that there's, when it comes down to 85. Popular cinema.
85 was back then.
85, there you go. So guess what?
Well done.
Guess what? Eric Stoltz was coming off.
Yeah,
he's coming off getting
like
sacked.
Eric Stoltz from got told, to
the
like, future.
No, I don't think he got. So one of the reasons why. With Eric Stoltz got Back to the Future was because of Some Kind of Wonderful.
Oh.
Well, then.
I think there was something.
How is that possible? Back to the Future's 80.
Because they're not filmed. Because of special effects and everything else.
Oh, no, Some Kind of Wonderful was definitely made.
Before.
No, it was made 87. Because.
87? Anyway. Okay, yeah. So it's the other way around then. It was something. Something happened. There's something in the back of my mind. I'd have to do.
You have to do a screen a dive.
We have to do a screen dive on it.
The screener dive.
But there was something which was a key element to him getting the part for that movie.
Absolutely.
And it was based off the back of whatever happened in the Back to the Future.
Yeah, it's unfortunate. I mean, it losing that movie kind of derailed his career a little, but still.
He got like Mask and all of that stuff, which was a hit.
Absolutely. Yeah. We talked about the school being a separate entity, and it almost deserves a credit in this. But there's a lot of people are key scenes in this movie that happen in that school. But talking about the setting, school is one of them. The other one is the city. And the city is L.A., and I just realized one thing, because I was doing a dive as well. We all dived. I never realized a very obvious thing about John Hughes. And that is that he has a very similar relationship and attachment to a city as much as, I don't know, let's say Woody Allen and New York.
Mm.
And that is Chicago. Every single John Hughes movie is set in Chicago. And this is the only one that is not set in Chicago. It's set in L.A.
Well done, Umber. That was something I did in the research.
If you think about it, even trains, planes, and automobiles as Chicago. It's an interesting little thing that I didn't know. And it's kind of nice. It's kind of nice to see directors that know a city so well and they don't write for any other. And that's another way to be effective, really, to be honest.
Yeah, to know the environment and let that environment feed into your whole film.
Yeah, the characters that you're going to write operate within that world and that setting, so it will be more cohesive. You know, there's more flavor to something like that. When it comes down to John Hughes as well, and his collaborators, freaking collaborator, which is Howard Deutsch, I wasn't familiar with his name that much until you know, we watched this movie. The next thing that he did just let me stay on John Hughes here for a second. I didn't notice one thing about his work, and it's unusual. If you look at the credits of his work, he died in, when did he die? He was 59, heart attack. We lost him in 2009,
yep.
Which, by the way, he died in August 2009, and we covered this movie. On the 6th of August, we covered this movie a few days after But when it comes down to John Hughes, he died in 2009, but he stopped directing much earlier than that.
Yeah.
His last and eighth movie was directed by him was Curly Sue with James Belushi.
Oh, yeah.
I've never watched it.
I watched it as a kid. It was one Curly of those movies Sue. That you would want to get as a kid because it was a kid on the cover.
Mm-hmm.
So if you were a kid, it's like, that's, you know, I can relate to that.
And more importantly, he only directed 8 movies.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's what I just said. Curly Sue was the number 8. But the other thing I didn't notice until yesterday, was that if you posthumously, there's a lot of his work that got made after his death.
Mm-hmm.
There's like all those like Home Alone sequels, whatever. They were scripts that never got realized or made. Or we are still making movies about characters that he wrote. Like if you look on, it's insane. It's insane, but it makes a lot of sense as well. He was a very prolific writer. And if you look at his credits, he has a ton of credits as a writer.
Mm.
I can assume that if you're a filmmaker making a rite of passage movie in the 90s and early 2000s, you will probably have him as some kind of consultant. The studio would go to John Hughes first.
But also, it's inspired other directors. Look at
Spider-Man.
Absolutely,
like Kevin Smith. We mentioned Kevin Smith. Look at Clerks or Mallrats. After this viewing of Pretty in Pink, so thank you for picking this, Rick. I never noticed the parallels. Steve, what were you saying?
More modern films like the newest Spider-Man trilogy. That was also, it has the same kind of quirkiness that you'd expect.
Well, the high school romance kind of thing.
Yeah, and the directors actually pulled straight from and said, the script.
Sam Raimi.
Is not Sam Raimi, because we're talking about the last 3 Spider-Man movies.
Oh, okay, sorry. I thought you were talking about the trilogy that mattered to me.
No.
That's all right.
But the quirkiness and the John Hughes-ness is all there.
Yeah.
But then there's homages as well. Deadpool. Mm.
Yeah.
So the first one with the Ferris Bueller's Day Off.
True.
Which is a perfect.
Although Peter Parker was written. Yeah.
Which we need to talk about.
Yeah, we do need to talk about
that. Because there is one direct breaking the fourth wall.
There is. And I wonder if this was the progenitor of basically the entire movie when it comes down to Ferris Bueller. They were made at the same time. But when Ducky turns around and kind of winks at the. I found that delightful. And you know why it was delightful? Because it happened once. And it happens right at the end. It happens after we gave a shit about this character. So if he does that, I want you to do it to me. Wink at me. Which, by the way, breaking the fourth wall and Tak Fujimoto. So we talked about John Hughes. We mentioned Albert Deutsch. He was a very... I called him... I don't mean to offend when I say he was very practical as a very functional director. What I mean is that it seems to me that he takes a job and he does a good job. And in fact, his career proves it. Because the next movie he did after this, Albert Deutsch, was possibly his last big feature, or one of the last big features. And it's a comedy that is may not be the greatest, but it's very close to my heart. And it was also the last collaboration between Albert Deutsch and John Hughes. And that movie is The Great Outdoors with Dan Aykroyd.
Oh my God, I forgot about that.
And John Candy.
Yes, yeah, so good.
The way Aykroyd plays that fucking character, Roman. Have you seen it? Have you seen it recently again?
Yeah.
It's still funny, man.
I haven't seen it, but I know the videotape I had got worn down.
Because it's a John Candy movie.
Yeah.
And if you're a kid and you don't like John Candy, then
there's something wrong with you.
Yeah, there's something wrong with you. But unless you're a kid that grows up in a world where there is no John Candy, which is, I'm sorry.
I mean, Howard Deutsch did a lot more work after that.
Yeah,
mostly
wait, that's what I was about to say. So I was saying that The Great Outdoors ended, it kind of was the last thing. And then he basically did a string of television, including stuff that actually had very notable success. I mean, when it comes down to The Zeitgeist, and that is True Blood. He worked on True Blood. He did a bunch of episodes of True Blood. He did a bunch of episodes of other stuff.
Yeah.
But I did call him a very practical, functional kind of, you give him a job, he does the job. And that's, I'm sorry, but that's what television is. Particularly. Yeah.
But I think you're also forgetting his work with Jack Lemmon and Walter Matthauer. He did sequel
Grumpy
for
Man.
Grumpier Old Man, and he did sequel for The Odd Couple,
my notes.
Too.
Yeah. Oh,
yeah.
Okay.
He did The Odd Couple, too.
Notable.
I mean, the way I see it is that
the masterpiece that is Grumpier Old Man.
Grumpier Old Man.
When a studio didn't want to put a two next to a fucking sequel.
But it leads to your what you said, which is like he was a functional director.
Yeah.
And I feel like that's why John Hughes was more than happy for him to take this project and the following project of Some Kind Wonderful, because it's like, and I know he can just get on with it.
Yeah.
Imagine being Tak Fujimoto working on both movies at the same time, or kind of, you know, because the two productions must have happened, must have crisscrossed at some point. So Tak was doing this movie, was doing Pretty in Pink, and then he was working on Ferris Bueller. Which, by the way, here's my segue, Tak Fujimoto. And why, you asked me earlier, so I want to watch The Struggle about making comparisons between Pretty in Pink and Silence of the Lambs. I'll tell you what the parallels are. You want to hear it?
Yeah, I want to hear it.
Go ahead. I want to hear this.
Close and then I want you to connect it to Grumpier Old Man, but carry on.
Close ups.
Yes.
Close ups in this movie, like they are in Ferris Bueller, like they are here, and like they are in Silence of the Lambs.
Especially when you get that first reveal of,
Yeah. If you remember Silence of the Lambs, you remember the fucking dick between the legs dance that I would fuck me. Would you fuck me?
Wow. That fucking there Buffalo are Bill so does. Many other scenes that I thought of before that one, but thanks for re-bringing that straight up to the surface.
Absolutely. Yep. I don't know how many girlfriends over the years I had to scare with shit like this, but every single person here has done it as well. Dick between the legs, tactile is like, oh. Absolutely. It's a must. But the other thing that you remember from that movie is the close-up of from Sounds of Lambs, possibly what is more notable, the thing that people, that it's ingrained in people's minds, is the one of the many monologues that, it's not a monologue, he's having a conversation with Clarice. And the way he's framed, okay, when it comes down to the way a sequence is composed, but when it comes down to close-ups, they're identical. And that stucks, like he's got a very, he's fixated with the human eye, first of all. That's one thing that he does very well. He captures the eyes very well. And in Silence of the Lambs, when Hannibal Lecter is addressing Clarice, he's not really addressing Clarice. He's addressing you. He's addressing the viewer. And in fact, the parallel here is that in that movie, which actually it's not really a parallel, but in that movie you have an actor that is, you know, the caliber of Anthony Hopkins staring into your soul, or when he's talking to Clarice. And in Pretty in Pink, you manage to kind of empathize, and you are going to dislike this, Ricky, but it's my opinion, okay? I really do not rate Molly Ringwald at all as an actress. And this role originally was actually meant to go to guess who? Jodie Foster. And she was a much better actress as a young actress. I mean, look at her in Taxi Driver. And it's the
I
movie
thought you were
services.
Going to say Freaky Friday then. Yes,
yeah,
I
no,
would
of
agree.
That as well. That as well. Absolutely, absolutely. They're two
or that
different
darn
worlds.
Cat. Was it that darn cat she was in yet?
And I don't mean to take anything away from Molly Ringwald, but I personally don't really rate her as a great actor. I really don't. And I never will. I'm sorry. I got nothing against gingers. Against gingers.
Yes, you do.
Nothing against my brother.
You know what?
Is a ginger.
This girl was wearing grandma glasses from the start of this film, and that, I just can't get on board with that. And her hairstyle, you know, she looked better in her 40s than she did in her teenage years, which never happens with women actresses. Is that what you were thinking, Umba? Is that what
Jesus
was going
Christ,
on in
man.
Your
I
head?
I don't know who that guy is, whoever you're talking about. That's awful.
Okay, we've brought up Molly Ringwald. So let me go on the defense of Molly Ringwald.
Okay.
When I was watching 16 Candles, and the last time I watched The Breakfast Club, the one I really wasn't getting on board with Molly Ringwald. Now, the reason for 16 Candles is because she kept having these weird monologues where she kept talking about her feelings, and I was just sort of like, oh, come on, get over it.
Yeah.
My goodness. Oh, just keep
You're
going.
That guy come. Now, man.
Yeah,
you are
but,
that guy now.
Anyway, and
oh,
then...
Oh, a woman's talking about her feelings. Oh, my God.
No. Oh, not, I never said I never said woman talking about her feelings. I was pointing towards a 16-year-old talking about her feelings, and it's like, okay,
it's all right. Throw some ageism in there as well. It's okay.
And then with Breakfast Club, I was just sort of like, what? Why does Judd Nelson want to get with that? Out of everybody in this film.
Yep.
Hey, wait. So, okay, I'm still trying to defend
Molly Ringwald.
Okay, yeah, please.
In this film, I started watching it and I was like, great, another Molly Ringwald film. You know, like I recently watched 16 Candles and I wasn't getting on with her in that. So let's see what she does. But by the time it got to the last act and she had those real heavy hitter scenes with Harry Dean Stanton and with Andrew McCarthy in the high school.
Okay.
Those were the scenes that made me go, I get it now. She may not be somebody on paper that you sort of go, oh, you know, this person should be our leading lady. But she pulled it out of the park. She absolutely hit a home run with those two scenes. Those two scenes were amazing.
Okay.
Now, what she turned that dress into, that's a whole nother story. I didn't like that dress.
Actually, dude, you know what? It's funny you say that. The person that did the clothing for this, and we discussed this in another episode, and we already shared with our listeners.
We're going to connect back to Mystery Men, everyone.
Yeah, we are. Yeah, the episode that you don't know if we did it already or we're going to do it. Now you know. There's no order to this madness. We're not recording this for you. You don't need to listen to this. All right? Now, the reality is it's Marilyn Vance. Yep. We talked about. And again, you know what? Marilyn Vance did not like the dress. And neither did Molly Ringwald. Molly didn't like the dress.
Nobody liked the dress.
And you know
what?
I
don't know who liked the dress.
That's the reason why they used the dress. Because Marilyn Vance, in the end, had to make a very strong choice, and I agree with her choice. It looks like she's wearing a fucking curtain, dude.
Yeah.
But the idea is that she's poor. And it needed to look like something that she put together herself. And it does look that way.
But the dress before, which was a 1950s dress, looked great. Yes,
great.
It looked great beforehand. To a point that Sally imagines this conversation that happened like after the film. It was like, yeah, you know that dress that I lent you, that my mum brought me? I didn't say you could destroy it.
Oh, is this your defense for fucking Molly Ringwald, dude?
She's
a shit tailor as well.
Yeah, but that was a Molly. As you said, Molly Ringwald said, "I don't like the dress," and I'm sure she would have if she didn't like. Oh, there's just so much about what Molly Ringwald represents to me in this film that made me go, she was the perfect person for. You can tell the film was written for her. Now, Andrew McCarthy.
The film was written. The film is actually. Yeah. Dude, you know the story of this fucking film. She went to John Hughes and went, I really like that song by the Psychedelics First. Yes, I know that it's Psychedelics First because Steve actually.
First.
Dude, if you saw him respond to me not fucking knowing the name of the band that played the song, he gave me a look from across the room.
Oh my god.
It made me question, fuck Klaus Jensen.
I'm not gonna tell you. I've gotta tell him.
He looked at me like you fucking idiot. And you know, you don't know.
This is probably another reason I picked this film because I recently saw the Psychedelic Furs and they still kick ass like now. And that film.
So,
the factoid,
wait a second. You saw them live recently?
Yeah, I saw them. They were on the same bill with Blondie and Alice Cooper at this
They played Pretty in Pink.
They played Pretty in Pink.
And
they
that is where you got the inspiration and why you dragged us into this 1986 pseudo.
There is another character.
Which is not. It's not a piece of shit.
We're getting your opinion coming through. Okay.
Wait a second.
Okay,
No, this is because you're defending Molly Ringwald, I'm upset. Okay? She's indefensible as well. All right? I got nothing against her.
You do.
It sounds
you
like
do.
It, you
do.
But
look,
I don't.
How dare you defend somebody who was 18 at this film? She was only 18 at this film.
No, man, stop it. Age,
she was only
18. Look at the girl that plays Bella in the Last of Us. What the fuck are you talking about? There's young talent out there, and You know, I'm not going to do this. I'm not going
to. You are. You're deep diving through this, man.
He's screen diving through this.
The six listeners we have are slowly turning off because they know exactly what you're going to say.
We don't care. Okay. So I lost myself in this, like, hatred.
Molly Ringwald hatred.
Yeah.
Have we talked about Ducky's
Dance?
Oh, yeah,
no. Wait a second. I've got a rebuttal, okay? So all you're right. defending Molly Ringwald.
Mm-hmm.
Steve, you may know this, please, because I got to put him in the spot now. Let me put him in the spot. Ricky, did you enjoy the Dahmer Netflix series? It was great. It was riveting stuff. I think it was. I hope you've seen it.
Wait.
The Jeffrey Dahmer, the Dahmer story. It was amazing, right?
Yeah. Yes and no, but yeah, go on.
But it was enthralling. It was entertaining.
I watched all of it. Whether I enjoyed all of it or not, that's a whole nother thing, especially because I knew a lot about Jeffrey Dahmer before going into it.
Like any other woman I know in the universe that is obsessed with true crime, she made me watch the show, and I enjoyed it, actually.
I enjoyed it. Obviously, what happened was not something enjoyable.
Of course not.
It's,
well, you're afraid we're going to get cancelled because I enjoy a series about serial killer.
Because you just want to put bodies in barrels in your lap.
I do not condone the actions of Jeffrey Dahmer. My fridge has no severed heads in it. No severed heads in my freezer.
But I do enjoy men at nightclubs.
And there's nothing wrong with that. Not that there's anything wrong
with that. No, there's nothing wrong with that.
Nothing wrong with that.
No, nothing.
So why am I bringing this up? Do you know what was in that movie?
Yeah, Molly Ringwald was in it.
Doing playing what? Don?
Was it Dahmer's mom?
Don't look
no,
shit
no,
up.
No. Was it Dahmer's mom? I remember she was.
She was. Yeah, and the thing that you're like,
did a good job.
Maybe, it didn't come up. Nobody said anything. The idea is, as an actor, I think your job is to be as memorable as possible, and she is one of the leads in this. If I think of Pretty in Pink, personally, the last person I'm thinking of is her.
Yeah.
The performances that really leave a mark here are John Cryer, which you can't take that away from him. He's unbelievable on screen. And he ad-libbed some stuff here, by the way.
Oh, a lot of stuff he's ad-libbed.
Yes.
The bathroom scene, for instance.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
What is it?
We don't get candy machines in our bathrooms. Yeah.
You got doors? You got doors?
You got
mirrors? It's like,
you know, like his entire character is fucking, he's really
and
funny.
The whole,
he's,
and even the whole, really like, Blaine? His name's Blaine?
Blaine?
Do you remember Andrew Dice Clay? Hickory Dock outside the fucking.
Yeah.
He's next to a barbecue. And let me finish this, all right? I said to Steve, what the fuck? Is that a barbecue outside a club? And then collectively, Anne, Steve, and Mari turn around and go, yeah, so? Like, what do you mean? Yeah, you used to get, like, Anne's like, you used to eat sausages. Like, that's what which made me feel extremely fat, by the way. The fact that Anne has a memory of us going clubbing, and the thing she remembers is me eating sausages outside a club. But the idea is that it's a
which sausages is, and onions.
Absolutely. It's a and we live in the UK. So worldwide this was a thing. They have a dude with a barbecue 100%. Just cooking shit that people could eat when they came out of the club. But the fact that, you know, you can see that the barbecue is decommissioned and it's just fucking Andrew Dice Clay talking shit and trying to
wearing
light up a cigarette.
A Dice t-shirt. A self-promotion and all that stuff. Yep. Brilliant.
And he gets shut down as well because he's about to do a very lewd joke. And that's when Ducky turns around and goes, and he walks away with her because it was about him getting on with her. But the idea is, look, I've got nothing against her. She's one of the leads. And I think they did it dirty. I think John Hughes did it there, and I think that's the reason, possibly one of the main reasons why they don't work together anymore. It's very unusual to have a movie that is not written for a lead. And I don't think this movie was written. You're right. It reeks of studio meddling. There's proof that the ending that we got is not the original ending. It just didn't work with test audiences. People wanted, but teenage girls want the good-looking guy to end up with,
bad teeth.
Did you hear what she said about... If they cast Robert Downey Jr. as Ducky, she would have been happy with the original ending.
Yes.
Yeah, and apparently, dude, nobody liked John Cryer on set. Yeah, no. And I think I know why. He had a very kind of, if you see him, like, even in interviews, he's very ADD. Like, he's very ADHD. He's got a lot of energy, and I think this was way before they were actually a diagnosis for people that may have had that. So if he was that high energy all the time, that would have been fucking exhausting.
Okay, can I just talk about Ducky for a second?
Absolutely.
Yeah, since we're already talking about him.
And his shoes, his Pinklepickers.
His shoes.
Yeah.
If you looked at his character...
Winklepickers. Not Pinklewinkers.
Winklepickers.
Winklepickers. They're not quite Winklepickers, are they?
What are they called? Wait a second, because I have to watch. Look at Steve. He's doing his research. He's not looking at us. He's looking at a screen.
I'm doing this. I'm behind the mic.
Wow. You're behind the mic.
I love that. It's like you want eye contact from Steve. It's as if he's doing some sort of operation on you, and it's like, dude, you give me that eye contact. God.
No. Hide behind. Super creepy. Super creepy, mate. What are they called? The shoes?
So they're not Winklepickers, are they? Because Winklepickers are the atypical goth boots.
But the shape, it's between a creeper and
they're more like a creeper, but they are pointed like a Winklepicker.
Okay, by now you could have just asked Google, really.
Yeah, I'm not going to ask
looking at a
Google.
Screen. I can see you looking at a screen.
I'm looking at this screen.
Okay, well, yeah, there's a second screen to the side. I know where you are. Ricky, I interrupted you. Go ahead. Sorry.
Looking at the character of Ducky through, again, modern eyes and stuff, why does he think he is entitled to Andy?
You mean James Spader's character?
No. We're talking about Ducky here. We're talking about John Cryer. So, like, we all understand now that to be somebody's friend and to be somebody's long-standing friend and only friend, because Andy has no other friends in the world.
He's not entitled to her. He's in love with her. What the fuck are you talking about? Are you trying to frame him under some kind of incel lighting? I am, basically. No, you shouldn't.
No, I am, because there are so many moments during the film, and especially like that club scene.
Oh, he acts like a dickhead.
Yeah,
he does.
He
doesn't know how to handle... Of course, there's a level of possessiveness. These people are young, dude. They don't have any fucking clue of what's right and wrong. Every single one of them.
This film is really interesting in the way that it kind of just puts shit upon shit on Andy from the get-go, from the moment James Spader goes, hey, Andy, how are you? Why won't you touch me? And all of this stuff.
That guy's a douchebag, though.
To the next one, which is like, you know, like the girls in the big, who made your clothes? We'd rather do the chapter, please.
Stop right there, by the way, because you're talking about Kate, the blonde one that goes out with Steph later. That actress was doing my head in while watching this movie. First of all, I did watch this in its entirety when it came out, I would have been completely enamored with her. She was hot as hell. Her name is Emily Longstreth, I think. Well, you see, the fact that you don't remember, and I don't remember, and Steve didn't remember, means that what the fuck? I remember either it was a type, because I remember looking at her.
It's a type, right?
But what was the name of, is it Kate Capshaw? She reminded me of a very young Kate Capshaw at one point. I was like, maybe that's what it was, maybe. Because I don't remember her name.
But
coming
I remember.
Was it Kate Vernon?
I did Battlestar Galactica. Like, I did the whole series in a very short space of time.
Hmm. Did you watch that episode of Portlandia?
No.
When they do the. Okay, I'll send you a sketch later.
Oh, great.
It's about the two of them watching Battlestar Galactica in its entirety. And. Yeah. Gradually, you can see that the phone's ringing. They begin to lose their job because they don't go in. Then they start cutting down the gas, the electricity, because they can't stop watching it.
Battlestar.
It's a phenomenal. Yeah. Anyway, go on.
But that's where I knew it from. But anyway, my point is that...
Kate Vernon. That's her name. Sorry. Kate Vernon. And she was in Battlestar Galactica.
Yeah,
is that what you're saying?
Yeah, that's what I was saying.
This is what I said.
Anyway.
Holy shit. What the fuck?
Welcome to the Umbar TV show, where Umbar realizes that even though he talks to other people, he is still just listening to himself.
Wouldn't know any other way.
Yeah. With Andy's character, she is being
Gina Gershon was in this as well.
Yes,
by the way.
She was. Yes. She was like one of the friends in the.
And I cannot look at her anymore after that movie with her and Matthew McConaughey with the fucking chicken leg.
Yeah.
What was the name of that fucking movie, dude?
Oh, Matthew McConaughey. Oh my god.
You'll never look. In fact, now when I eat chicken, I don't eat chicken legs anymore.
Oh my god! I know exactly the film. Joe. Something Joe.
Oh, this is okay. Steve anyway, is already on IMDb for sure. Yeah,
everyone's Steve, now can you shouting for the at name? Us, like, how do you not remember that film?
Exactly. If there's anybody listening, it's like, who the fuck are these guys? All six. What are they talking about movies?
All six.
It's the name of a state or in the title?
Eskimo Joe. No.
Eskimo. No? What? What the hell are you talking about?
Eskimo Joe's turn an up. Australian band.
Turn up. Turn up. The stereo. I met them. I've got a photo with the singer.
I wouldn't be surprised because they don't get out of Australia and they meet all of their fans
great.
After.
I actually really like them and they're great live as well. So
I know.
What
I saw them.
For? Yeah.
Anyway, something Joe. Killer Joe. God, that's
Killer
what
Joe. Called. It was a name. Okay, it's not the name of the state or whatever. But in the poster, I think there was I don't know if it's Texas. I don't know. I can't remember.
No,
but anyway,
it's like the most obvious one, Killer Joe.
Yeah.
Anyway,
Gina Gershon. Fucking hell, Gina that Gershon. Sequence.
And the funny thing is, I look at her and I think Face Off, or I think Bound.
Oh, 2011.
So, yeah, I know, but that's the last fucking thing I saw her in that was so.
Yeah, it's got a chicken. Looks like it's in the form of Texas or something.
Yeah. That's the poster.
Definitely Texas. Have you seen the movie, Steve?
No, I have not seen this movie. That's why I'm
Matthew McConaughey plays against type in this one, and he's a fucking unbelievable.
I haven't seen that film since when I first watched it. Yeah. Sally walked out during that scene.
Yeah, it's
she
full on.
She couldn't handle scene.
It's full on. You know what? We'll watch it at some point.
Yeah, sure. We'll add it to the list.
Absolutely. So, hey, it's an hour and 13 minutes, so you better get to where you're going, Mr. Ricky.
I've been trying, but you know what?
Oh,
your
fuck
ADHD
off. Just get there.
Laddled mine.
Yeah.
Oh, you keep segueing.
Give me some meds.
I'm trying my hardest with you, man. I need to caress your face
just
or something
get to
and
the
just
point.
Be like, listen to me.
Go.
Okay, so she gets shit upon from a great height throughout the whole of this film. And Ducky, for some reason, just because he is her only friend, or she is his only friend, decides that he has complete ownership of her throughout the whole film.
Okay.
I think he's got a crush on her.
He does.
He's a teenager.
Yeah, I agree with
Steve. And he's not being
he's
able
not
to...
He's sound mind, mate. He
of course not.
He's not of sound mind.
He's
well,
not
he's
able
a brilliant
to
character, but he is not
talk
of sound
he's a fucking
mind.
Teenager, dude.
Yeah.
If these were adults, they would be psychopaths, all of them.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, they would.
It's insane.
Or James Spader would be going around axe murdering people, wearing his yuppie food.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He'd be doing his best Christian Bale impression up and down.
Yeah, exactly. Right. That's what I was just like, full on.
Oh,
back
we
in
have a Ted Hooker in the trunk, Andy. fuck you. Would you want to end up like her? That's
Where's Jared Leto? Where's Jared Leto?
That's American Psycho in pink. That's what you basically. But they're teenagers, so you know.
All right, okay. Let's talk about our general feelings, our scores, all of that stuff. I've got a feeling
Steve.
You want to shoot straight to me, or do you want to shoot straight to
no,
Steve?
No, Steve. I think Steve should go first. Oh, I don't want to hear your voice anymore, Ricky. Go.
On hindsight, I mean, on a second watch. Well, second full watch. I'm not a big fan of this movie. I like the actors, especially the supporting cast. I still have a crush on Annie Potts in this movie. Who doesn't? Oh, there's one little bit of trivia on Annie Potts as well.
Yeah.
When she says, when she answers the phone at Tracks, It's exactly the way that she answers it for Ghostbusters.
No.
Yes.
No, Janine. 100%.
She did.
We she got was... one.
But yeah.
Yeah.
But I mean, like, it's,
wait a
it's
second.
One of
Don't
things...
continue with your final statement. We would be remiss. I need you to hold it right there. But we missed out something key here, man. All of us.
Okay.
Otis Redding, John Cryer, yeah. Dancing scene. What the okay. fuck? How do we skip over that, man?
So I was going to bring this up as
yes.
part of
and the
my
music,
final...
Steve. You should talk about that as well.
Yeah. So I've been trying to talk about the other character in this film, which is the music.
Yeah.
Which is freaking amazing. It's an amazing soundtrack. I still remember it very well and kind of fondly because it's it's got Smiths, not Morrissey. Which is a great kind of thing. I've got the soundtrack right here in front of me, and it's got OMD, it's got NXS, mm-hmm. it's got the Smiths, it's got the Psychedelic Furs, which this entire film is based on.
True, absolutely.
I mean, Echo and the Bunnymen, New Order, it's a who's who of the 80s.
There's a few tracks by New Order in it, actually, more than one. Can you do me a favor? What's the name of the track
Shell
by what's the name of the track by OMD?
If You Leave, and it was made okay. directly for this movie.
True.
It and was and
it was our use contacting yeah. them directly. That's so, what I, you know the trivia about this, right?
Yeah, they had another song ready to go and mm-hmm. they made this song in 24 hours
because they were meant to tour.
Yeah,
but I guess when you know, John, did I say Howard Hughes? I meant John Hughes.
John Hughes contacts you and says,
Howard Hughes was
hey,
going nowhere. He was calling nobody.
We want a song by you.
With yeah. fingernails as long as this. No, but...
And it went to become a hit for him. So
yeah,
that's,
it did.
That's really good.
It
yeah.
did. That's true. That's true. Yeah. But that's what I'm saying. I guess if John Hughes calls you, you say yes. You know,
yeah, especially at that time. Yeah. I mean, like, fantastic.
The Otis Redding sequence, dude.
Okay, so the Otis Redding sequence, it was supposed to be in another track.
True. Are you yeah. telling me the one that you know about?
Okay, so I know that it was supposed to be in a Mick Jagger and Michael Jackson track.
Yeah.
Correct, and it's the first yeah. time I realized that both of them have the same initials.
Shot. Yeah.
I never thought about it.
MJ.
Yeah.
So, but they couldn't get the rights to the song. That's it. So, yeah.
Okay, so that's the one you know about, right?
Yeah.
Was it State of Shock?
State of Shock.
Okay, the second one that was meant to go on, they couldn't get the rights for, and it was a Rolling Stones track called Start Me Up.
Start Me Up.
They couldn't get the rights.
I knew about
Start
Me Up, for sure.
There you go. Yeah. So in the end, they went for something else. Okay. That entire sequence, man, I don't really normally look at choreographers, but I have to look the guy up.
Okay.
His name was Robert Paulson. What movie am I actually quoting now?
Okay.
Bob.
Robert Paulson. Went on to direct.
No, dude, what the fuck?
I'm sure of it.
No, Robert Paulson. I'm quoting Fight Club.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
His name was Robert Paulson.
Yeah.
His name was Robert Paulson.
It's not the name of the choreographer. Yeah. The name of the choreographer.
Okay, sorry. No. The guy who did the choreography for this.
Yes, and his name, it's not that. His name is... Anyone help me here? Come on, it's in my notes and I can't... Oh, Kenny Ortega.
No.
Kenny Ortega.
Yes.
Yeah. As in High School Musical.
Yes.
No way.
You know that. Who are you? What? Why would you know that?
Mate,
I actually didn't put it on my notes because I didn't want you guys to fucking laugh at me.
Okay.
My God, what the fuck are you, man?
Weirdly enough, I did a short film, music for a short film, a few years ago. Yeah. And after that short film aired at the Prince Charles Cinema, they sat us down and watched High School Musical 3.
Oh, my God. Three.
Not even two,
I was just
man.
Like,
not even two.
But I was just like, Christ, oh, my God, we're going to watch another movie. Oh, God. Great.
Anyway, that was one of the movies that I found the two credits for.
Hey,
and
I think you keep forgetting, as much as I am a film buff, I also am a primary school teacher. So I have to sit through
Dude,
a lot of these films.
You're putting your hands forward now. Stop. Let's just move forward. Okay, you said what you've said. We heard you. Everybody heard you.
Hey,
are we supposed to be wrapping this up?
Maybe.
Yeah, okay.
Maybe.
Right. So we got Otis Redding, and we got Taku Fujimoto capturing John Cryer, doing one of the most memorable dances that I think that's why I said this is the originator of fucking TikTok. He's mouthing the entire thing. He's dancing to it for the camera, and it's great. I loved it. I was smiling all the way through that sequence, man. I really, really liked it.
It was a fun sequence.
Yeah. Did you know there's no shoes? There are two pairs of those shoes, and they were like a size too small.
Ouch.
There's interviews out there with John Cryer saying that basically they were tearing his feet, and every time they had to keep repairing them because they got them secondhand. They found them secondhand. They found two pairs, and they were a size too small.
Yeah, by the end of the film, his feet just went straight through the sole.
Of the viewer? Okay.
Funny.
Nice pun. All
right. Let's go.
Okay. Steve.
So, I'm hesitant to say. I mean, the supporting cast for this movie is fantastic. I'm not a big fan of Maury Ringwald in this movie. As we've kind of said in other parts, it's a 2 for me. I mean, like 2.5 at max.
Out of what? Out of 5 or 10?
Oh, okay. Out of 5. All right. I always collapsed.
And it's, we're going to have to find.
Okay, we're going to have to come up with what we're going to start doing.
No.
Okay.
2 out of 5. Well, yeah. You can say 2 out of 5. It's fine. And what are they? 2 to what? What
so are it's you giving? It's a 5, okay. Technically, right. Out of 10.
So would you
five
say
out of 10,
that?
But what are you using? I would, it's not 5 stars. What is it for you? It's 5 what?
It's 5 pairs of pixie boots.
Yeah,
whatever.
Now can I just ask? With that 5 out of 10, was it still? Did you find the film still watchable?
I found it watchable, but it didn't do anything for me extra. It didn't pull me. It made me realize some of the cast were still amazing actors. Some of the cast members. The story is a competent story, but I think it's badly
handled.
Done.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's goes nowhere. It's like a. Eh.
Yeah. That's
what Mari said, by the way.
Yeah.
Yeah. She's right.
She is right. Yeah. But it just feels like of a time. And but that time has passed, sadly. There you go. I mean, like it's made well. The supporting characters are good, but it doesn't do anything for me.
Okay.
Yeah. Ricky. Sorry, guys.
No, sorry. What?
No, you don't need to be sorry because there's actually quite a lot of what you've just said that I was going to echo. However, okay. I'm going to give this one probably closer to a 7 out of 10. 7 out of 10. You're a bitch. That
7 out of 10, you're a bitch.
You're a bitch.
That's great. Just for James Spader's.
But the reason why I'm giving it a 7 out of 10 is because would I watch this again? The answer is yes. Would I, when my kids grow up, would I put them through it? The answer is yes. Now, I also see that it's not a great plot line. I also see that it is very derivative. But in terms of the Romeo and Juliet Cinderella storyline, I think it was a very fresh take on that. And it was actually quite a cozy take on that. But
it was an 80s take on it.
It was a very 80s take on that.
Yeah.
But with that slight edge of like, oh my goodness, did they just drop the R word? There was a point where I thought Harry Dean Staunton dropped the N word, but then I looked it up and it was imbecile. He said the word imbecile, but in his Harry Dean Stanton way where he's like, imbecile. And I thought, whoa, did he just say? No, he didn't. He didn't say
it. But there were different times, you see.
There was a different time. But there was, and I think going into this film, I thought at the end of it, I was like, oh, what are we going to talk about? And then slowly, the more and more I thought about it, the more and more I talked to Sally about it, there were so many things to talk about. There's so many like little strands and little things. And just like, you know, we could have spent this whole podcast talking about James Spader. We could have spent this whole podcast talking about just John Hughes and his path to this movie.
Mm.
There's so much going on in this film that I would be more than happy to give, like, sit people down and be like, shall we watch a bit of a crappy film, but have a lot of fun doing it? That sort of thing. So I would personally...
Wait, did you have fun doing it?
I had fun in the way that I kind of kept, like, character studying. Like, each character came up, I'd be like, why would they do that? Or... what's going, like, why is James Spader, like, witnessing all these conversations? Like, why is he just hanging around in the hall and stuff? Even the, we didn't talk about the John Cryer, James Spader fight, but that was such a realistic kid.
Yeah.
Like, fight. Yeah. But anyway, so personally, yeah, I would give it close. And if you think about it out of five, it's only three and a half out of five. But yeah, I'd give it like a low 7 out of 10.
Okay. That's not
10
bad.
What?
Oh, I said 10. You're a bitch.
Yeah. I was going to rate mine Spader cigarette butts, but I'm not going to do that. I'm going to go for pink dresses. So, yeah. So, as much as it sounds like a very, very dangerous and threat, like there's a threat tone to it, I'm going to go for pink dresses. I was going to give this a 7. Your dispassionate and ridiculous defense of Molly Ringwald has pushed this down to a 6, Ricky. You originally, I was like, oh no, you subjected me to this. So I asked you to pick a movie and you picked this piece of shit. I fucking hate you. But I still hate you a little bit, but not for this. Not for this movie. It was enjoyable for me to watch. The movie feels like, again, I don't want to use this term loosely, but it feels like a time capsule for me. And it's a bit weird. It's the most, out of the bunch, this is the most, even more than Breakfast Club, man. This movie is very 80s. It's got a strong, strong 80s presence in it. Like it's got the bad guy, and it's got the, you know what I mean? It's got all the tropes in it. And for a teenage drama, normally you wouldn't have this, because you would be tempted to call Spader's character, to call Steph a villain.
He is.
And
he
you
is
don't
a villain
get,
of a space.
In this type of movie like this, this is like a, it's a rom-com. You don't get a villain, you get a bad guy. But he's villainous in this. And there's, again, there's no threat to his villainy because it's a douche. So it falls on him. It's there's an ensemble of things.
He's a yuppie douche.
Yeah, absolutely. And I also don't recall being so repulsed by two leads at the same time. Every time Andy appeared on screen, I just kept thinking, how the fuck did you get this role? Like, he just is not a good looking dude.
Well, yeah,
and I don't think
we don't ask that question because
regardless,
we probably know the answer.
That's the way I felt repulsed by both of the leads. You know, like, if anything, I was attracted by the performances here and the charismatic kind of presence and aura on screen from Eric Sandin's character, from James Spader's character, and John Cryer knocks it out of the park, really.
Yeah.
He may be playing someone who does detestable things later on in the movie, obviously, you know, but it's a spectrum. That's what I'm saying. Like, I wouldn't cast him completely under this or shine a very dark light on him. I just think he's a teenager, doesn't know what the fuck he's doing. His response to being rejected is it's demented. But it's also hurtful, and he tries to make up for it later. But these are things that you do as a teen. You know, the youth is stupid. What are you going to do? We all did stupid things at some point. Again, if you throw these character traits at adults, you made a fucking American Psycho. You did. But the teens, you know, the stakes are very low. Let's just put it that way. And if one thing is kind of, one thing that we get out of the ending, which is, okay, the underdog doesn't get the girl, fine. But it also goes to show that you know that this relationship is going nowhere. You know, like, it's just a, yeah, okay, they'll kiss afterwards, after the prom, and whatever the fuck. It's just the fleetingness of youth, and I think the movie remarks that. So what am I giving this movie? I said, it's pushed down to a 6. But that's not a bad thing, because a 6 out of 10
is not
terrible.
It's still better than Sharknado 3.
Yeah,
you know, I rated a 5 because it's a 5. It's a solid movie. It's just it doesn't do anything for me.
It doesn't
anymore.
Stick with you.
No. I think it's a 5 is a little harsh, but Steve,
no,
that's your 5.
But
it's
you
my
know
5.
What? Mm. It's interesting because I watched the Siskel and Ebert review that they did at the time.
They tear through it.
And Ebert was like, 3, 3.5. I loved it. It was quaint. Gene Siskel was like, 1, 1.5. What is this? It's so derivative. And they're like really at each other. And to a point where Roger goes, yeah, so you just kind of prove that you don't know cinema again, Gene. Anyway.
So,
I mean, there are highlights to it. That's it. Yeah. It's just that I don't really gel with the main cast directly. Mm. But
the leads, you mean?
The leads. Yeah, yeah.
Nobody did. Besides Ricky, who's secretly in love with Molly Ringwald, we discovered. I hope Sally listens to this episode.
As I said, you know, like, I've put out my reasons.
It's not a bad movie.
Opinions. I would have kept it as a secret kink of yours. But now everybody knows.
I've got so many more secret kinks to come up in future episodes. Don't you wait. Just wait.
Hey, how about some body horror?
Oh, yes. Oh, my God, yes. Yes, please. Yes. I need some Cronenberg in my life, please.
Yeah, that's what
please,
I was going to
please.
And on that note, thank you for listening, people. Thank you for spending time with us. You know that if you enjoyed the show for whatever sick reason, please recommend it to your friends, to your family, to your co-workers. Just push it on to people. Put it on social media. Click that bell. Smash the bell. Subscribe. Do whatever. But follow us.
Like.
Because you know what we're doing next week? And we're not telling you. Until then.
But we're going to discuss this after this call.
Yeah, right now.
Yeah. Until now, we didn't really reveal it. We're not going to reveal the schedule, I think. But we got something good coming next week. I'm pretty sure.
Sure we do. Yeah. Yep.
Yeah. I'm sure we do. Not necessarily.
I mean, we
movie.
Do. We definitely do.
Yeah, we do. Yeah.
Might be a 2 out of 10 after your guys' reactions to my film. But yeah, it's fine.
Okay. Well, see you later, guys. Until next week.